Hello, everybody. Welcome to our event today. My name is Martin Grant. I'm the Dean of Science at McGill. We want to celebrate something here at McGill today. It's really common in universities that spin-off companies happen and that people commercialize their ideas for research. But what's unique about the idea here is we're celebrating what we do here. We're recognizing it. We're showing that it's something in which we take pride. And the basis of that, frankly, is a conversation I had with John, I don't know, was it like 5 years ago? I don't know. We were, I think it was here of all places, actually, downstairs. And I think it might have been fueled by a tiny, I hope the camera's off right now, a tiny little bit of alcohol. And John told me a story about his great uncle, Reginald Fessenden. Reginald Fessenden had transformed the field of radio technology by transmitting speech wirelessly. Now, this Quebec-born tinker joined Edison's lab when he was just 20, and his ingenuity and brilliance led to more than 500 patents. It's a great story with one exception, is that Reginald Fessenden had to do his work in the United States, even though he was a Quebecer. And what John said to me 5 or 6 years ago is perhaps we can ensure that there are no more Reginald Fessendens, or rather, no more Reginald Fessendens in the United States. Let's have them in Canada, in Quebec, and at McGill. Let's take advantage of the great renewal that's taken place at this university and have the future Reginald Fessendens here. So, in 2007, the Blatchford family literally transformed McGill science with a gift that rewards scientists who commercialize their research. It's named in honor of their family forebear, Reginald Fessenden, and there's a gift of $1.5 million with other money. I'm not sure I'm supposed to say these things, from Richard Tomlinson, which partly matches that fund, to create the Reginald Fessenden Professorships and Prizes in Innovation. John endowed the Fessenden Professorships and his son, Eric, who's unable to be here, the Fessenden Prizes for students. Their generosity and vision is the reason we're all here this evening, and we're joined by the recipients of the professorships, and I think almost everybody is here, given between 2008 and 2012. Now, this is something we've always done at McGill, and part of what we're doing here is not only, how do you say it, not only recognizing it, but also naming it and claiming what we actually do at the university and what we've done here for a long time, saying it's something in which we take pride and which we'll celebrate. McGill Science has had no shortage of innovation. The development of plexiglass in 1930 or the 1980s research in the Automass Chemistry Building that led to AZT, the first drug, Bernard Belot's work, to fight HIV and is still in use throughout the world. For the past 4.5 years, the Fessenden program has been instrumental in reorienting McGill's research and bringing the best new ideas to market. The Fessenden professorships are intended to promote the development of spin-off companies based on intellectually rigorous research. And I think that's the cool thing about this, is that, you know, it's a university, right? People like smart people and innovative ideas. And that has already come out of the Fessenden program. So, yeah, maybe you know, tons of money will be generated by it, but the intellectual activity of itself is important. The Fessenden Prizes recognize achievements in innovative research and commercialization potential. They're open to students at both undergraduate and graduate level, and indeed to professors in the Faculty of Science. 11 Fessenden Prizes have been awarded to date. And I'd like to recognize this late afternoon the person at the helm of this program who's ensured that it's been a success, Erica Besso. Well done. Well done. Erica has been instrumental in encouraging our scientists to explore the commercial potential of their research. In her role, Erica has literally created the infrastructure to help our professors work with existing companies and to start new companies. What was just a germ of an idea when John and I sat down 6 years ago requires more than a couple of guys sitting down and having a beer together. It requires some hard work to make it actually reality. The professorships and prizes are awarded through a semi-annual competition. typically held in the spring. The invited proposals are peer-reviewed, and recommendations for funding are made to the dean. What's unique about the program is that we not only have, to tell you guys, the mistake of most programs like this, including the NSERC Synergy Program, is to have only scientist review awards. What's done here is we have successful entrepreneurs review the awards as well. And the two together are essential to make the professorships a successful program. Indeed, the Blatchford's gift came at a pivotal point. I can't say this strongly enough, so I hope I don't go on too long, because I never understand these events. I used to go to these events where the dean would speak, and I'd say to myself, boy, do I find it tiresome to hear the dean speak. And every year I do this job, I find it's more natural for the dean to speak and go on and on and on. Look, I want to thank John and Janet and Eric, particularly for this award, because you know what? McGill has been going through a huge sea change over the last 5 or 10 years. We have a quality of young professors we have not had here for a long time, and we needed help, and we needed a push at the right time, and that's what we got with this program. And I would like to have a little round of applause for the Blatchford family. We're going somewhere here, and it's because of them that we've got a big, big push to help us. Okay, so we've got a bunch of speakers. They're all speaking for exactly 5 minutes about what they're doing. It's fun. I've heard what happened was Erica and Derek Wong and Peter Gruder and I were hearing these milestone proposals of what people are doing, and I thought, boy, these are great. And I thought, we need to celebrate what we're actually doing here. Anyway, we have six speakers today, the six professors, and we're going to start with Nick Moptessier. Nick.
Thanks, Martin. I'm really honored to be here. I'm really honored to be the first to speak tonight. I've been very privileged to be one of the six awardees. I'd like to thank you before even starting presenting my research and results, and it has been very helpful in ultimately setting up a spin-off. So that was a successful story, thanks to your support. I have 5 minutes, so the dean can take more time, but not the speakers, right? It has been locked. Someone knows the password?
Technology.
Thank you. Okay, so what I'll tell you tonight about is the development of a platform for drug discovery. So before starting showing a little bit about the platform itself, because I just have 5 minutes, I'd like to put this in the context of the pharmaceutical industry nowadays. So just some snapshots of what we're facing today is the first one being it takes over 15 years to start from an idea and to end up with a drug on the market. So 15 years, obviously, it's a long, long process. And as written down below, it says it's much harder than rocket science. I'm really proud of this statement. It's not mine, but I think it's a very good statement saying that it took about 12 years between the start of the space age and the man on the moon. And it took more than 15 years to start with the discovery of a disease and the treatment of this disease. And it takes about $1 billion of investment. So there's clearly a hurdle when starting a drug discovery project. So why is it so hard? Because getting activity, blocking a biological process is somewhat easy. But making a drug requires much more than just blocking a biological process. A drug has to be, as written here, active, obviously, but also absorbed. It has to go to the blood. It has to be soluble in the blood. It has to be metabolized by the liver, cleared by the kidneys, should not be toxic, should be stable chemically for shipping or for storage. It should not bind to plasma protein and so on and so forth. So there's a long list of properties that a drug should have, and not only just being active. So there are many ways to find a drug. Serendipity is probably one of the most successful so far. But getting investors investing on serendipity is quite difficult. So you have to come up with new ideas. So either you're trying whatever you have in the bank, so you're taking millions of molecules that are available, you're testing them all, and you hope. Again, getting investment from hope, it's difficult. And then you have rational design or predictive software. So this is where we stand. So what does that mean? Ideally, what we'd like to do is give as many molecules as we can to a PC. The PC would evaluate solubility, absorption, activity, toxicity, and end up with one and say, this is the one that you need. Hopefully within not 15 years. Otherwise, there's no benefit from this software, but hopefully very quickly. But the main problem we have is this. You don't like to see this. I don't like to see this either. Let's be honest. Sorry for physicists. Sorry, Paul. But I don't like to see equations. I'm an experimentalist. I'm a medicinal chemist. I want to make a drug. I know everything about chemistry, or I hope, or I believe I know everything about chemistry. I don't want to see this. So if you want to bring the software to the lab, you need to make it simple. And this is what we came up with. So this is the software we've developed. I just show you one example. I'm a chemist, and I want to know if my drug would be metabolized by the liver. I go to the web. I go to this website, which is the program we've developed. Put my name, login. Then I click. I want to do my new job. I click on add a job, give a name just for the fun of it. Continue. This is what we have. Now scroll down. This is what the program tells you. You need to give a molecule, and it would develop. It would tell you whether it's metabolized by the liver or not. And then you click here. I'm a chemist. I still haven't seen any equations, and I'm really happy with that. I draw a molecule. I'm drawing my molecule. This is a sketcher I'm used to. I scroll down. I save it. That's all I have to do. Click on the pen. That's a nice icon that we spend time selecting. Then you select what you want. So these are four enzymes known in the liver. Select the one you want. Save the whole thing. Update. And finally, start your job. What the program will do, it would understand this 2D structure, would make a 3D structure, would understand what this enzyme in the liver is. Everything is fully automated. And then you click on start. It runs the job. Would tell you, so we have lights, like a green light. If it's green, it's done. If it's orange, it's running. If it's red, it's just not started yet. And then you can do as many experiments as you want, completely virtual, with no knowledge of any of the equations. And then at the end, that's what the program tells you. So this is the reaction of the drug with one of the enzymes in the liver that has been found by the program. Tells you that the drug is metabolized where we have the arrow. And a medicinal chemist now, I have to make chemistry. I have to do chemistry to stabilize this site, make the molecule more stable in the liver. So now as a chemist, I can really use this software. First, it's web interface. It's a web interface. No need to update my stuff. Because as a chemist, I don't want to update my program every single week. I just don't want to care about everything. I can use my old laptop, my iPhone. It's on a server somewhere, so that's going to work. And that's, we try to think about all what I would need as a chemist to use this software. And now it's really made possible. So this is metabolism. We have activity. We have selectivity. We have many other properties that can be predicted just by a few clicks and hopefully accurately, because that's the development in my lab was really to get accurate predictions, and the commercialization was to make it available to chemists. And this was only possible through your support. So as I said, thanks for your support. Molecular Forecaster is a spin-off that came out of this research. We have now a few sales. I'm really happy to say that. And hopefully it's gonna grow further. I'd like to thank you again for your support.
Very nice, Nick. I confess that it's true that a picture is worth a thousand words, but on my theoretical physics PhD thesis, I have a quote which says, one equation is worth a thousand pictures.
That's why we have thousands of pictures.
Paul Wiseman.
So my talk's entirely filled with equations, and... No, I took them out.
I didn't mean to start a
debate. I guess, yeah, there we go. Okay. So I'm Paul Wiseman. I'm in both the departments of physics and chemistry, so I get to see both sides of the fixture. But it's a pleasure to be here at this, what is really a celebration of the Fessenden project. And I'd like to, as you'll see, special thanks to John for this, because I'll indicate in terms of flexibility that this gave in terms of developing the technology that I'm going to describe. So just to set the stage, the idea behind this was that we had come up with the idea, or actually I'd seen, came up with the idea that when I saw the structure of the malaria pigment hemozoan and saw a talk about the structure, I kind of realized that it might have a high nonlinear cross-section. What that means is that I had the idea that if we shine a femtosecond laser on such a pigment, it would emit light at one-third the wavelength of the fundamental laser. It's like optical, it's like harmonics and acoustics, but in light. So we actually tested it, and there you can see on this thing a red blood cell with two parasites and the blue spots. That's third harmonic generation, basically optical singing of the byproduct of the malaria when we shine a femtosecond laser on it. The other nice thing is, you can get it at very high signal to noise. So if the infection is there, you get this emission, and if it's not there, you don't see it. So we thought that this would be wonderful in terms of trying to develop a diagnostic for malaria, obviously a very huge disease for large portions of the world. And what we came up with, we went on to get, apply for an NSERC I2I to bring this into terms of a device that could be commercialized. And I'm not going to go into details, but this was the original idea that we had, and this was also what the Fessenden was funneling into to help us commercialize. Basically, we were to take a femtosecond laser, focus it on a blood sample, and be able to read out. Now, the idea we initially had was to oscillate the sample and rotate it within vials within the beam, and for various reasons, this was not optimal. What the Fessenden bought was flexibility in terms of changing direction and having extra time to deal with it, whereas NSERC, it was like 1 year, boom. John, the flexibility brought by the Fessenden chair allowed us to actually implement a totally new direction where we switched to a microfluidic device. The idea being now that using the advances in microfluidics, you would simply stream small volumes of blood samples and through a focus, the focus, and interrogate the blood cells one by one and look for the response individually. And we looked at that. So here is an example in the lab of the setup. It has a fiber laser and then a chamber. This is, of course, just a demonstration, but with the microfluidic device. We should also be able to generate the microfluidics by femtosecond ablation through a colleague in Colorado. And so the idea is simply, it's like if you remember from elementary school, I don't know, we used to have fire drill and stuff, and the teachers would count, and then they'd say, Wiseman, you out. Like, that's the basic idea. We interrogate the cells one by one. Upper left-hand corner, this is uninfected blood. Note the scale, up to 0.8. B is an infected, malaria-infected blood sample. Note the scale up to 5 on that one. The plots below superimpose the infected and non-infected, and note the scale is shrunk. So you can see the background from the uninfected sample versus the infected malaria things. Now, with a twist on this, we can add a diode laser and actually just do scattering off and count all the cells and then cross-compare and say infected, non-infected, get levels of infection within a quick run through the microfluidic. Here's another example showing infected blood at various stage, and you can just literally count the peaks on this, and with a PC come out with a quick assessment of infection. So I say a deep, it's hard to convey the thanks that I feel to the program, because it really gave us the flexibility to totally change the direction and come up with something that really was more optimal than what we had initially proposed to NSERC. And for that, John, I'm deeply, deeply grateful. I'm also extremely excited about future directions, because I recently found out from the McPherson lecturer, Theodore Hansch, it Turns out his spin-off company was supplied our fiber laser, and he was quite interested in this technology, and he said, oh, you'll be able to build a field device. And I said, well, could we do a fiber laser in the field? You know, how could we do that? And he said, well, we're about to produce a battery-operated fiber laser from the company. So it was like, great. So in terms of future. As well, there's various industrial interests. Derek Wong can talk about various companies that have expressed interest in this. If you're interested, Intellectual Ventures has actually done a TED lecture incorporating aspects of this technology in their TED lecture. And one final thing in terms of science and directions where you don't know where you're going to go, in talking with Philippe Gros in biochemistry, I found out that his lab is actually doing multiple drug treatments that target the enzymes that package the hemozoan as a way of combating malaria. This type of approach could be a potential aspect in terms of screening the efficacy of these drugs that target hemozoan production, because we can get a readout on what's happening and how many hemozoan are there. So with that, I thank you for the support, and I think it really is an amazing celebration, and I'm deeply grateful that this is in existence and that I was chosen as one of the Fessenden professors. Thank you.
Well done, Paul.
Thank you, Martin.
A little over, but still well done. I just made that up. I wasn't actually keeping time. And our next speaker is Masad Dama. Masad.
So to put our work in perspective, I thought perhaps I would go directly to the collaborations that we're actually doing with researchers at the MNI Institute. And I have to say this collaboration started because the Office of Technology Transfer, now called OSR, had a very good idea of what we were doing in the laboratory and also about the work that Kevin Petreka was doing. He had identified a gene target that when knocked down, it basically stops a tumor cell from proliferating. But he didn't have the compounds that would target that and would stop basically brain cancer from spreading. And so at that point, we started to talk about this, and we began this collaboration. So he was very fortunate to find out a gene target that is overexpressed in invasive gliomas. So this is glioblastomas. Apparently, it's not too difficult to treat. You use radiotherapy and you reduce the tumor. But when it comes back, 95% of the time, it goes and spread aggressively. And there is very little that you can do. Half life expectancies go from 12 to 14 months for the most successful drugs. So we thought maybe there is something that we can do together. So we're using these constructs. These are nucleic acid duplexes, just like DNA. And we're taking advantage of this natural pathway that takes our compounds and get loaded into this complex intracellularly and then goes and target the mRNA that actually codes for that DRR protein. That's the one that we want to knock down. And so because we're after the message that produces the protein, and not the protein itself. As Nick said, it takes a lot of time to develop small molecules that target the protein because we're going after the message. This is called RNA interference, and this is an analogy of turning off the tap rather than mopping up the floor, basically, once the damage is done. And so that was the idea. It turns out these constructs works in silencing particular proteins, so we're actually comparing these chemically modified duplexes with some unmodified nucleic acids. And the advantage of using these chemical modifications is that you want them to be stable once they enter the cell. Also, if you feed cells with double-stranded RNA, you get immunostimulation, so you get flu-like symptoms, which is something that you want to do. So these modifications are helping us to do this. Just to show you some of the assays that Kevin has come up with, where he basically plates cells And then using a spatula or a pipette tip, he actually scratched the cells, and then he watches them as they come together. So in other words, measuring how quickly they move. That's the invasion assay. And that, so after 72 hours, the cells have actually filled the whole plate. But when treated with our compounds, you actually slow down that process significantly. The challenges now are going to be how to deliver these molecules, and that's actually our next step. Just to show you that in addition to affecting the mobility of these tumor cells, you actually change their morphology. So it's actually quite striking when you take these malignant cells, glioma cells, and then you treat them with the double-stranded nucleic acid. They basically change morphology. They resemble now more the typical cell, rounded with very strong focal adhesion. So they stick more to the other cells and to the surface, which is exactly what you want to do. You want to immobilize them. And then to check that the molecules are getting in, you actually put a label. And that allows you to excite the label so that you can actually see these are entering the cells and likely causing the effect. The other project that we've been working on is development of these monomers. These are building blocks to make long-chain RNA. The difference is that we want to do them on a chip. We want to be able to grow these RNA and then use them to interrogate RNA-protein interactions. And so this is important in diagnostics, for example, because you want to detect proteins or biomarkers for disease. This is so-called aptamer microarrays. You want to look at RNA-binding antibiotic screening, which is actually very important today in trying to identify better antibiotics. We did here is for the first time being able to grow RNA on an RNA chip. And so those are the two projects that we were thanks to the support of the Fessenden grant. And so that created intellectual property and opportunities to move forward with these technologies. The RNA chips are being now licensed to a U.S.-based company that is producing these RNA monomers. And the duplex technology is now being pursued in partnership with the M&I Goodman Cancer Center and a company that is actually pursuing delivery of these molecules for ultimate treatment of this. And that, of course, leads us to some funding opportunities. So just like everyone else, I'd like to thank the Fessenden Initiative. I hope, Martin, that other faculties are going to emulate this. I think it should not just be in science. It should move beyond that. And, of course, the students, two of which have made the progress that I show you, and the collaborators, in particular, Martin and Erica, as well as Astrid, who's sitting actually at the back, and other people who've actually helped me through the project. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Massad. Very nice and very generous, and thanks for the pen. The, it is true that the Fessenden program is unique in North America. It's the only such program in a faculty of science in North America. The only other ones I found like it were at ETH Zurich, and I think there's one program in Ireland. But as Massad said, it's now being at least copied within McGill, and the Faculty of Engineering has now copied the program, and we'll have a version of it going next year, I understand. And with that, ask Dave Burns to speak.
If I can get this mouse, there we go. two things I wanted to mention about the kind of the Fessenden program and the initiatives and how it's played itself out in my laboratory. First of all, is really the prizes. Fabiano Pandozzi received one of these prizes for some work that we had done in the lab and a company that is spinning off. He unfortunately couldn't be here today because literally they're working on this method for non-invasive head trauma. This is Fabiano right there. And Leap Medical is commercializing this as a startup, and he's in Detroit looking at head trauma. So who'd imagine there'd be head trauma in Detroit? But he really appreciates this, and very much it's helped him kind of move this forward. So there's one aspect of it. The second one is really a project that we've received a Fessenden professorship on concerning the use of development of really smart hydrogels, but for a specific application. We had developed some of these ideas of this so many years ago, and like Paul Wiseman mentioned about optical singing, well, we went to ultrasound, and we tried to get molecules to sing. So effectively, if you get a molecule that binds to something, it'll sing at a different note. And effectively, we could use those notes and the set pitch at which it sings to be able to tell us something about quantitation. So we had developed this up for doing things like point-of-care type of measurements, where you could take a simple transmitter, put it through the sample cell, and with a receiver then translate that to what the particular pitches are, and then the combination of those pitches tell what the molecules were that were developed there or bound there. And so this was really attractive, and we were looking at it for doing a point-of-care type measurement. Going into point-of-care is really difficult because you've got a long, long lead time to get in through all of the regulatory components. So we were looking around, and one idea was to look at water quality business. Because the water quality business in general is amazing. Huge numbers that we're talking about, as I put here, 8 to 13 billion a year projected, and 100 million a year for specific water quality pathogen detection. And so we were saying this is a marvelous place to go and try to do some measurements like this. What came on board at that time was Peter Ruse, and I can't see Peter. Right, there's Peter. Peter's in the back. And Peter and I had worked on a separate company a few years ago. And with Peter on board, we kind of strategized. What do we need to do to get this off the boards from just doing measurements in a point-of-care type situation to do something actually on the water quality assessment? So we said, well, we need to do a feasibility study. And in particular, to do a feasibility study of an important pathogen, Giardia. Giardia or Cryptosporidium are two that are very common waterborne illnesses that have much problems around the world. Plus, the test right now is $500, and it's mostly based on a visual microscope examination. So it's very time-consuming. We thought we might be able to automate it. So what the Fessenden professorship essentially allowed us to do was Peter developed a hydrogel with essentially a paper, a hydrogel that is a squishy paper. And this paper is nano scale, so much, much smaller than the size of your hair. And that will change a resonant frequency with binding to the Giardia. And the signal is huge. And effectively at around 3 megahertz, we see big changes in the signal. And the therapy or the commercial measurement range is in a very tight region here that we can easily span. And so effectively with that and a new piece of information, which is one thing that they would be really useful to do, would be to measure both live cell and dead cells, because they do that visually by putting dyes inside the cells. And we came up with a scheme by which we could label the Giardia, and the unlabeled versus the labeled Giardia have a different signature. And in fact, we can see a big change with that. And that actually led to some new intellectual property. So the strategy for what we had for this was to try to actually come up with some sort of a project line and get a business out, because Peter is going to spin out here in this next year and a half, to try to move it actually into a commercial sector. So this will be a platform technology and something that many things can be developed on top of. But the first emphasis will be the water quality initiative. So for that, we need some continuing funding. So what we did was we took the initial results that Peter had and those findings, and we put it into an I2I proposal with NSERC, and we were successful. And now I can tell you that the I2I proposals have gotten much, much more competitive. What they were about 50% success rate, now they're down to about 20% success rate. And effectively, it's because the people are expecting more and more with regards to the amount of preparation for the data. And we got feedback directly that said, had we not had the type of feasibility studies that the professorship was allowed, that allowed us to generate, we wouldn't have gotten the proposal. So a key point was that. With that, we've essentially talked to various business associates around Montreal to figure out how to structure this business. One of the nice things is because of the success of this proposal and the Fezzenden proposal, we were able to connect with a business school group which have helped do a marketing study, and we're developing a business plan, and we'll be presenting it to two investors on the 23rd. We'll have a whole bunch lined up after that. One of the key things that came out of that is to get a little device about the size of a toaster that effectively can be run by your cell phone remotely. And effectively, this little device will sit there and allow you to do the analysis dynamically. And what's taken many, many days to do in a commercial setting now by microscopy, because there are many steps involved, now can be done very, very quickly. So our next phases are trying to take this and extend it further and get a startup company in a year, year and a half. So thank you very much. I really is needed support.
Thank you, Dave. And I should mention, it's my understanding that, I mean, money is not the most important thing in the world, or even the second most important thing in the world, but the program has already leveraged a factor of six beyond the funds that were actually used to get it going. Our next speaker is Yula Zantrizos. Yula.
Expressing my most sincere gratitude for this award. It has made a tremendous difference to my career, especially since I only started at McGill 3 years ago. And as Professor Burns mentioned a few minutes ago, when you go to funding agencies, they require a lot of preliminary data to fund you. And so when you're just starting, you don't have a lot of preliminary data. So this award has really made a significant difference to my research. My research is focused on drug design and the development of tools that can be used to evaluate disease states. One of the things that is clearly known is that human disease states affects our metabolic pathways. But what is not clear is whether our metabolic pathways cause the disease, going out of control cause the disease, or vice versa. It is known, for instance, that in certain types of cancers, there are two enzymes, the human farnesyl-pyrophosphate synthase and the human geranylgerin-pyrophosphate synthase, that are upregulated. The people who have cancer have much higher levels of these enzymes, and they produce higher levels of metabolites due to these enzymes. Similarly, neurodegenerative diseases, particularly Alzheimer's, in postmortem autopsies reports of people who have died from Alzheimer's, it has been shown that these enzymes are much higher, they produce much higher, or they have produced higher concentrations of their metabolites. And so there is a correlation between Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, and the overexpression of these enzymes. So the goal of my research was to develop tools, chemical tools, that can be used to find out whether Alzheimer's is caused by the upregulation of these enzymes or whether it is a consequence of the disease. I have had the good fortune to collaborate with people who are experts in the field and are working at the Douglas Hospital to be able to evaluate our compounds. And the design of these compounds is to be selective inhibitors of the two key enzymes, the human farnesyl-pyrophosphate synthase and geranylgerin-pyrophosphate synthase. To give you a little example of what these types of disease do and what kind of drugs that hit these enzymes can provide, in this slide you have the only drug that is currently available on the market produced by Novartis. It's called Zometa. It's a very small molecule. And what you see here on the left-hand side is a normal bone from an animal, which is perfectly healthy, whereas this is the same animal after 6 weeks where it has been incubated with prostate cancer from a human. So clearly, a compound which can inhibit these enzymes may be able to prevent at least this from happening. But it has been shown that it does a lot more than that. And unfortunately, the compound which is in the market and is used today was never developed for this purpose. It was discovered by accident, serendipity, as Professor Montesia mentioned. And so there is a need to develop better pharmaceuticals for this particular purpose. Here's a compound that we have synthesized. Has an inhibition concentration for 50% of the enzyme of 10 nanomolar, which is quite potent, but it is completely selective. It does not inhibit the similar enzyme, the geranylgeranyl pyrophosphate synthase. Here are compounds from our competition. You can see that they are not as potent, and they are not selective. This compound, for example, is equipotent in the two enzymes. Selectivity is extremely important if you want to avoid toxicity, and flexible molecules like that will bind to multiple targets, and they can be a serious problem in the clinic. Here is, in collaboration with Dr. Michael Sebag, who is a hematologist oncologist at the Royal Victoria Hospital and the Montreal General Hospital, we have tested our compound, one of our compounds. Our compounds have many different structural features, and we are profiling them as we go along. And we compare them to Zometa from the Novartis compound. As you can see, the Zometa compound is much more potent than our compounds, but there is a reason for that. And we purposely avoided having a feature, this hydroxyl group that you see up here, which causes a loss in potency in the enzyme, but it causes affinity specifically to bone. We want our compounds to go through cell membranes and to go into soft tissue, because if you want to use them to treat myeloma or prostate cancer, you need to have them have an exposure to soft tissue. So even though our compound is eightfold less potent in the enzymatic assay, in cell-based assays, it is as good or even better. What is more exciting is in collaboration with Dr. Jude Poirier, who is an expert in neurochemistry and neurobiology at the Douglas Hospital, we've been testing our compounds in the ability to decrease phospho-tau, which is a protein that is associated with the killing of neurons in the human brain. We have used human immortalized neurons, and we've tested the Novartis compounds against our compounds, and we look at the phosphorylated tau, which is a toxic protein to the neurons, and you can see we have lower levels than the control. Of course, the Zometa compound also has lower levels than the control, but it is extremely toxic. This LDH is an abbreviation for an enzyme which represents toxicity. It's a typical assay for measuring cell death. So our compound does not cause the cells to die, but it does cause decrease in this key protein, the phospho-tau, which is associated with Alzheimer's. And so I'm still have a few months to go in completing this project, but we hope that in the long run we will have at least an advanced lead that can be used to see whether a compound that goes through the blood-brain barrier can slow down or completely stop the progression of neurodegenerative diseases. And, of course, all of this work requires the funding, and I'm immensely grateful for the funding I received from the Fessenden Professorship, but it also does more than make molecules. It provides training for the future generation of scientists, and these are the people in my group who have been participating in this project. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sheila. We cannot guarantee that all these projects will be as successful as Bernard Belot's, that is a treatment for AIDS, of course. But you know what? We're not going to do it by serendipity anymore in the Faculty of Science. We're doing it by design. And finally, Greg Dudek has agreed to change his talk to be about drug design rather than robotics.
So I'm going to have to switch computers, which will just take an extra second, which is why I'm going last. So the presentation I'm going to give is going to be a little bit more prosaic than the ones we've just heard. And I'll talk really about the very practical things we did that allowed us, that the Fessenden Award allowed us to do, which I think would have been pretty much impossible otherwise. Prosaic, but important, and I think which had a lot of impact on the work that we continue to do in the lab. Okay, so the project that we worked on was about robotics, and it was about taking robotics and building essentially a robotic project. And it leveraged years of work on underwater vehicles to make a commercial product, and years of work by a pretty large team of students and colleagues as well. And in fact, I've been going to meetings for many years hearing about, you should really take this technology and spin it out in some way. But in many ways, it's really not practical in the normal academic world to spin things out because it takes a lot of time and a certain amount of money and just energy that is sometimes hard to find. And so, you know, I satisfied myself for many years writing papers. And I think my students, Yogesh and Vikram, are the guys who actually, by the way, did a lot of the heavy lifting in writing those papers and doing a lot of really good work, but not really being able to get this out the door. And finally, the award allowed us to kind of take to the next level and do that. So the work that we do involves this vehicle. It's a hexapod, a six-legged vehicle that swims underwater. It uses computer vision to swim around underwater. It uses some very pretty techniques based on big, huge equations, which I won't show you. can dive to about 130 feet. And it's made to work with a human operator. So there's essentially a whole linguistic aspect where how humans, robots can communicate and operate underwater. And I won't talk about that either, because I'm really not going to talk too much about the underlying technology, although maybe afterwards I'd love to talk about it ad nauseum. And I'm sure they would too. We've been doing work all over the place. We've done some up in the high Arctic using it for astrobiology kind of applications. We've done a lot in Barbados for McGill House facility, which is very important to us. We can put it in water without freezing to death. And of course, we do work here near McGill. And just to give you like a little bit about robotics, which motivates us and motivates me, I think it's really at the verge of reshaping our world in a big way. I mean, it's hard to imagine that in 15 years we're not going to see robotics everywhere, robotic cars and robotic kitchens and robotic vacuum cleaners and robotic elevators and robotic wheelchairs, and it's going to make a big impact. It's impossible that it won't. And I think one issue is, where is Canada's infrastructure in this game? And so one of the ideas here was to try and add to that infrastructure or build some of that infrastructure by creating something locally here in Canada. So our original plan for the Fessenden project, my original plan, was to do a few things. Do IP protection, do a bit of technology refinement, take stuff that worked well enough in the lab to write papers about and be able to push it out the door and actually do something real with it, and look at commercializing that. So actually build a company, set up a beta test program where people who are interested in this technology could borrow it and use it, and then use some of that to introduce the robot to people who might really want to buy it down the line. So we did a bit of that IP protection. We licensed, we got a couple of patents, and we also licensed some patents back from McGill that we had in the pipe already, and one that predated us. So that technology acquisition process was pretty successful. Many of the students that you saw on that slide, or older students than that, were involved in part ownership of the patents that we built or that we acquired. We did some technology refinement, so we took stuff that worked on the lab bench and in the lab, you know, for a couple of hours at a time, and we built real systems that really work, and Bikram, who's sitting on the edge there, was critical in actually building those things physically, and Yogi was critical in actually making the insides of them come together, be smart enough to actually get the thing working. I think this process of technology refinement, of course, never ends, but it got good enough to really be usable by people who weren't my own student or my colleague. And we have a commercial version of the robot, which is much better than what we had previously in the lab. We've built a lot of technical manuals and documentation and basically got an understanding of what it takes to make these vehicles. That's something you really can never do with NSERC money. And it's critical to taking a kind of cool idea that works once and building a technology that works every time over and over and that you can really duplicate and sell. The robots have a lot of neat features. I won't talk about them, but they have cameras, they have computers inside. They have lithium polymer batteries that let them go very deep. They have flippers that let them swim and legs that let them walk. We created a spin-off company that sells them. It's called Independent Robotics. That's the website of the company. We created robots that were built essentially for the company, branded by the company. We found an international distributor who's shown this to the trade shows, basically demoed it a little bit, continues to do that.
trying to get that into the hands of potential purchasers. We've got a sales product channel now for literature that follow up leads, give quotes, gives us quarterly reports on how things are going. This is their website, which our robot is showing on the front page here in those big red arrows. They have a rotating set of photos, so they mistakenly show other robots occasionally. But they show ours prominently, which is really kind of nice. We had some unpleasant surprises along the way. Building the software and getting it bulletproof and so that it never fails turned out to be harder than we expected. I think Microsoft is still working on that lesson. We had some serious hardware failures along the way where things just didn't work. You know, something basically exploded. It caused us a lot of stress, a lot of cost overrun, but that's kind of part of the game. It's part of what this allowed us to work through and get to the end of. And there were some challenges, too. We couldn't hire students to work on this industry-oriented project on campus. Sorry, we couldn't hire company people to work on campus. There were constraints on what people could do that were essentially administrative barriers. That's okay, but it was a challenge to us. So far, we've sold one robot. It's been paid for. It's been delivered. It's living happily in Mexico right now, as of today, in fact. Or maybe yesterday. This is what it looked like when we sold it. That's the robot in its case on the right, a whole bunch of extra gear that we sell with the robot on the left. So it worked pretty well. We've started up this company. It's in the black. We've got some good leads for future sales. It's had a huge payoff for the lab. Aside from the fact that we created a company which will hopefully make jobs and make money for somebody, maybe not me, and be very good, It's made our research much better because all that documentation and all that technological refinement allows people to do scientific work in the lab that doesn't involve tinkering incessantly with things that weren't properly documented the first time around. So it's that payoff is, you know, I expected it to be huge and it's been bigger than I expected. And it's been used, now that we've got this company, it's actually been useful to assist other faculty members who actually want to have some linkage with it. So that's been a kind of nice bonus. In terms of future sales, we don't want to sell a lot. The robots sell for about $70,000 each. So if we sell three or four a year, that's the ideal target until we basically find some way to expand very big, in which case it has to move on to probably somebody else's hands. If you want one, talk to me afterwards. I guess it was harder than we expected to get going. That's one of the reasons why having some kind of assistance was critical. I guess I was right in a way never to do it until I had the help of something like the Fessenden Award, and yet it was a great thing to have done. It was harder to build that sales and get it going. It's not an easy process. We had a lot of mishaps. Things seem to be going pretty well. It looks like we have a nice process for incremental growth. And having a company that's connected to McGill on the inside turns out to be very useful for all sorts of other reasons. So, you know, helping other professors build industrial linkages. And I have a little tiny video of the robot swimming underwater. This is kind of what it looks like. At the moment this video is playing, it's running Yogi's software to swim around on under the sea and look for interesting content on the coral, on the coral reefs. Oh, we also got a large recording artist to donate his music so we could legally show videos with music. So what is that? It's what the robot's doing now is it's swimming along the reef and trying to look for interesting coral content that it's going to basically record for biologists to look at subsequently. So we worked for years with biologists, but it also walks a little bit. So it does a number of different kinds of things, different kinds of mobility, different kinds of gaits, and I'll stop there. Yeah, it's a Canadian robot, so it has the almost unique ability of being able to walk on snow.
Very nice, Greg, very nice. We not only have professorships under the Fessenden program, thanks to Eric Blatchford's gift, there's been support for students as well. And I just like to read the names of students. I think some are, I know at least one is here, but some are here and some are not here. And I'll say what they do as well, and I think that's as interesting as their names at some level, if they're not here. So Josiana Lafleur won a prize for the development of centrifugal microfluidics devices. David Duford for design of a centrifugal magnetic pulverizer used in on-site environmental monitoring. Alex Labuda, sitting over there, for his work in optimizing signal-to-noise ratio in atomic force microscopy, Teresa Dankovich for research on paper filters for sustainable water filtration, and Andrew McCann for an alignment tool for distributed mirror systems in 2011. Valdemar Kalishov for his work on pricing mechanisms for bandwidth and electricity markets. Valdemar is an undergraduate student. And Dave already mentioned Fabio Pandazio for his work on a portable non-invasive instrument for analysis of the brain surrounding fluids for head traumas. And Alex, again, for his work on a user-friendly optical beam deflecting system. And finally, Gregor Lushik, for his development of a crowdsourced carbon dioxide assay for the Montreal urban environment. So all over the place, in other words. Now, on behalf of the Faculty of Science, I'd like to present a small token of our appreciation to John and to Eric. Eric's not here, so we'll have accepting the award on Eric's behalf, his mom, Janet. And we have two things here. Come on. We're into the protocol moments now. So, Janet.
Thank you so much. Eric will be thrilled.
It's a picture of Reginald Fessenden, and they actually look like hoodlums from the 1920s or
something. That was a great adventure.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Well, it's my pleasure, and but what I do is nothing. What you guys have done has actually made a real difference here. With that crazy kind of thing that I have a tendency to say, I'd like to invite people to go back to the room to have another couple of drinks on our behalf. And the professors and John and Janet and Erica, if we could, we're going to get together for kind of a picture thing. And I think we're going upstairs to the Tucker room to do that. So let's have a nice round of applause again.